Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Today, we open our show with some national news headlines from Public News Service, including a look ahead at the fall election and why predictions of a red wave may be fizzling, plus hear about President Joe Biden gearing up to defend his student loan debt forgiveness plan in court. We'll have a report with details on that student loan forgiveness plan and just who qualifies for it on today's show. The Buffalo Bills have given the boot to a star punter and former San Diego Aztecs football player after a civil suit alleges he instigated a gang rape of a 17-year-old Grossmont High School student. San Diego's Bishop McElroy is now a cardinal. We'll have details on his induction ceremony at St. Peter's Basilica in Rome and how he stands to influence who becomes the next pope later on today. Santee won't be having a city council election this fall. That's because nobody filed to run against the incumbent council members. And in Lemon Grove, the city has announced some job openings, so stay tuned if you're looking for work. Our newsmaker interview today is with Dilquaz Ahmed, the executive director of License to Freedom. We'll be talking about the tragic shooting death of an El Cajon woman, a Syrian refugee with 9 children. Her husband has been charged with murder, but family and friends say the Al-Rawis were a loving couple, and they're shocked at the allegations. Dilquaz has been counseling the couple's children and will have an update for us on their situation as they struggle to cope with their devastating loss. From California News Service, we'll have a back-to-school checklist for parents today, and finally, we'll take you on the road to the Water Conservation Garden at Cuyamaca College, one of East County's hidden treasures. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Trump has cost them the House in 2018. He cost them the Senate in 2020. The House is likely to flip, but he very well could cost them a very winnable Senate majority, too.
Cook Political Report editor Jessica Taylor says the chance of a red wave in November is shrinking, as former President Donald Trump's chosen candidates create fractures in the GOP. With the overturning of Roe v. Wade and the January 6th congressional hearings, the generic congressional ballot is all but tied. Cook's outlook for the House had been a GOP gain of 20 to 30 seats, but that's now 10 to 20 seats. In the Senate, the parties appear tied with 8 toss-up races. A little more than 2 months until Election Day, political analyst Bill Kristol notes President Joe Biden's approval is up slightly at about 42%. He says an unpopular president is a drag on his party.
On the other hand, voters are also capable of saying, not crazy about Biden, but let's look at the two parties that are competing for control of the Senate and the House and what their agendas are and what their leadership is. And Trump is now as much on the ballot as Biden.
Meanwhile, an Axios poll found about 60% of Republicans want Trump as their nominee in 2024. Politico reporter Andrew Desiderio says Trump is using the FBI raid on Mar-a-Lago to his advantage.
That's why he was the one to make public the FBI search in the first place, right? Because he believed, and I think correctly, that this actually helps him with his base of voters.
On Friday, the Justice Department unsealed a heavily redacted search affidavit, which showed the boxes seized included confidential, secret, and top secret documents. Intelligence agencies say they are studying possible damage to national security. President Biden was asked about Trump's assertion that the documents were declassified.
I've declassified everything in the world. I'm president. I can do it all. Come on.
A federal judge is expected to appoint a special master to independently oversee a review of the material per a request from Trump's team. Some in the GOP say they're looking at suing the Biden administration over student loan forgiveness. Biden wants to erase up to $10,000 in debt for those meeting income requirements, $20,000 for Pell Grant recipients. Critics say that's unfair and doesn't fix the larger problem of skyrocketing college tuition. Biden is using the 2003 HEROES Act, which gives the education secretary power to give students debt relief during a crisis. Deputy Director of the National Economic Council, Bharat Ramamurthy, says the White House will defend the plan in court.
the president was clear from the beginning that he did not want to move forward on this unless it was clear that it was legally available to him.
I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our eTrust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Hey, how are you? Well, they're too good.
If you have a federal student loan and earn less than $125,000 a year, you are eligible to have $10,000 forgiven, or $20,000 if you were a recipient of a Pell Grant awarded to help low-income students attend college. President Joe Biden announced the plan on August 24th, also extending a pause on student loan repayments until December 31st. In addition, Biden's plan caps future repayments at 5% of a borrower's monthly income, down from the current 10% threshold. An application for the partial student loan forgiveness will be posted later this year. Borrowers can sign up at ed.gov/subscriptions to receive updates on the federal student loans. But why are so many students having trouble repaying their loans? Higher tuition costs, coupled with a 32% decrease in federal student aid since the early 90s, and COVID job losses all played a role, but perhaps the biggest problem has been changes in recent years in how interest rates and repayments are structured. With recent loans, some students paying the minimum required payment find that interest continues accruing until they soon owe more than the original loan amount and have no way to pay it off as the debt keeps climbing. Lemon Grove resident Brian Rickle found himself in this situation. He writes on Facebook that the vast majority of us have always paid our school loans on time, every month. Not only have we not even made a dent in them, many, like me, owe a lot more than we originally borrowed. We are simply looking for fairness in lending that doesn't saddle a person with debt the rest of their lives just for getting an education. He calls the system broken and says a long-term fix is needed. Some Republicans have sharply criticized Biden's partial student loan forgiveness. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell called it student loan socialism that is astonishingly unfair. He accused Biden of giving away government money to elites with higher salaries, though Biden's plan does not forgive loans for anyone owning more than $125,000. The White House fired back at some Republican members of Congress who hypocritically criticized student loan forgiveness after their own companies received far larger Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP, loan forgiveness during the pandemic. Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene said on Newsmax that the student loan forgiveness is completely unfair and complained that taxpayers, quote, shouldn't have to pay off the great big student loan debt for some college students that piled up massive debt going to some Ivy League school. Her comments ignore the fact that many of the loans were made to students attending public colleges and universities, not Ivy League schools. But the White House revealed Green's hypocrisy as well as inaccuracy, since Green had over $183,000 in federal PPP loans forgiven. That's the equivalent of 19 student loans. Other Republican congressional members who criticized the student loan forgiveness also pocketed huge sums through PPP loan forgiveness. The White House tweeted the amounts and just how many student loans could have been covered with each. Those include Vern Buchanan, who had $2.3 million in PPP loans forgiven, the equivalent of 230 student loans. Others who had PPP loans forgiven include Markway Mullen, $1.4 million, Kevin Hearn, $1 million, Mike Kelly, $1 million, and Matt Gaetz, with nearly $500,000 in federal PPP loan money forgiven. While Republicans largely oppose any student loan forgiveness, others argue that Biden's actions did not go far enough. California Labor Democrats say the real issue with student loan debt is the inflated and compounding interest added to the original federal loan. The labor group posted on Facebook, "Anyone who takes out any sort of government loan should pay back the principal. But anyone who takes out any form of government loan should not be shackled for the rest of their lives into a modern form of sharecropping or indentured servitude due to mob-like compounding interest that never reduces the loan amount." The White House has not released figures on the exact amount of student loans eligible for forgiveness. According to the New York Times, 45 million Americans owe a total of $1.6 trillion for federal loans taken out for college. The amount forgiven would be far less than that, since the Biden plan forgives only $10,000 of the money owed, or $20,000 for Pell Grant recipients, and nobody earning over $125,000 a year would have any loans forgiven. President Biden defended his actions on Twitter in response to Republican critics, stating, "I will never apologize for helping America's middle class, especially not to the same folks who voted for a $2 trillion tax cut for the wealthy and giant corporations that racked up the deficit, a reference to actions taken when Republicans had control of Congress and the presidency. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
The Buffalo Bills have given the boot to star punter Matt Araiza days after learning that he's accused in a civil suit of gang raping a 17-year-old girl last October, along with two other players who were on the San Diego State University Aztecs football team at the time. Araiza received the Ray Guy Award last November as the top punter nationwide in college football. Brandon Bean, general manager for the Buffalo Bills, tweeted an announcement that Araiza has been released from the team, stating, "Our culture in Buffalo is more important than winning football games." While all the facts are not yet known and no criminal charges have yet been filed, Bean said, "We just think it's the best move for everyone to move on from Matt and let him take care of this situation." He added that the Bills only learned of the allegations in late July. The civil lawsuit accuses Araiza, along with Xavier Leonard, a current Aztecs player, and Nolan Pa'aiwalico, a former Aztecs player, of gang rape and more. San Diego police, after an investigation, have referred evidence against all three men to the San Diego County District Attorney, Summer Steffen, to consider filing charges. According to the suit, the underage victim was a Grossmont High School student who had been drinking with friends at other parties before going to the Halloween party at a residence on Rockford Drive on October 17, 2021. The girl, referred to as Jane Doe to protect her identity, became separated from her friends and was approached by Araiza. The suit claims that Araiza handed the intoxicated minor a drink that contained not only alcohol, but other intoxicating substances, before having sex with her and then leading her into a bedroom where she was allegedly violently assaulted by several men for over an hour and a half. Photos provided by her lawyer, Dan Gillian, to our news partner 10 News, show red marks and bruising around her throat and on her leg. The suit says when the party was shut down, she stumbled out bleeding from her private area and had several piercings torn from her body. The girl immediately told friends she'd been raped and reported the rape to San Diego police the next day. An officer took her to a hospital for an exam. After determining she'd been a victim of violence, police asked her to call Araiza, and they took screenshots, which reveal that he admitted having sex with the girl, a minor, and told her she should get tested for a sexually transmitted disease. Sex with a person under 18 is statutory rape under California law, whether it's consensual or not. The suit accuses the three football players of rape, gender violence, and false imprisonment for subjecting the teen to, quote, cruel and unjust hardship. The property owner is also being sued for premises liability. Gillian called the incident a horrific crime, the kind of which happens all too often, in an interview with Times of San Diego. He has accused San Diego State, San Diego Police, and the DA as enablers, looking the other way because the defendants are prized athletes. Araiza's lawyer, Carrie Armstrong, claims the suit is a shakedown because he's now with the Buffalo Bills and calls the rape accusation false, the LA Times reports, although the girl reported the alleged assault promptly before Araiza was drafted by the Buffalo Bills. Leonard's attorney, in a statement reported by 10 News, says no conclusion should be jumped to regarding this young man. Iwaliko's attorney has noted that the civil action does not have any bearing on any criminal charges. SDSU waited until last month to announce its own Title IX investigation. A statement from the campus says the school was asked by police not to conduct its own probe earlier to avoid potentially compromising the police department's criminal investigation, which includes subpoena powers. However, the university has stated that it takes allegations of sexual assault seriously and is complying with state university policies, which could lead to suspension, dismissal, or expulsion if a remaining student is found to be in violation of the student code of conduct. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Former San Diego Bishop Robert McElroy was inducted as the first cardinal from our region during a ceremony on August 27th in St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. McElroy, along with 18 other new cardinals from five continents, received a scarlet skullcap, gold ring, and silk hat from Pope Francis. Cardinal McElroy, who is 68 years old, also joins an elite list of potential candidates to become a future pope. Only cardinals under age 80, including 16 of the newcomers, will be part of a conclave to elect a new pope from among their members whenever the current pope dies or steps down. The College of Cardinals now consists of 226 cardinals, including 132 eligible to serve as electors and potentially pope. Pope Francis, at 85 years of age, has named more cardinals than any recent pope, selecting 112, 83 of whom are electors under age 80, according to Vatican News. During the ceremony, Pope Francis encouraged the new cardinals to remember poor families, migrant, and homeless persons. Pope Francis, the first pope from South America, chose cardinals who largely share his vision of a more progressive, inclusive Roman Catholic Church. Cardinal McElroy has been outspoken in his agreement with Pope Francis's progressive views on issues such as environmental preservation and welcoming gay members into the church. He has also opposed banning communion for politicians who support abortion rights. In choosing McElroy, the Pope bypassed conservative archbishops in San Francisco and Los Angeles. Committed to having representation from around the world, Pope Francis named four cardinals who are the first from their countries, Mongolia, Paraguay, Singapore, and East Timor. Other cardinals appointed are from the United States, Britain, South Korea, Spain, France, Nigeria, Brazil, Italy, Ghana, and Colombia. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Marie Johnson.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
In a first for the city of Santee, two incumbent members of the city council were appointed to another four-year term and will avoid the November election because no challengers in either district filed papers to run against them. Rob McNellis in District 1 and Ron Hall in District 2, both Republicans, were both approved to continue representing their areas by a 4-0 vote at the council's August 24th meeting. Each of these incumbents abstained during the vote on his own district. According to a report by City Clerk Annette Ortiz, nobody filed to challenge them by the deadline of August 12th. The city could still hold an election, but by appointing the two, it stands to save between $16,000 and $36,000. Hall, who runs an insurance brokerage company, will be serving in his third term on the council. He says a lot of people are likely burned out by the pandemic and just aren't interested in running for political office. He also speculated that when the city changed to holding district elections in 2018, it gave incumbents an advantage and discouraged challengers who likely have limited name recognition and less knowledge on how to stage a campaign. The city decided to adopt district elections because of the threat of a lawsuit by an outside attorney who was suing any city in the state that didn't do so, Hall said. At the time, they said doing this would create more diversity on boards, but in reality, it didn't solve the problem, Hall observes. Santee has racial and ethnic minority residents among its population of about 60,000 people, but they're spread out fairly evenly throughout the four districts. Unlike some districts in the city of San Diego that are dominated by certain minority groups and thus have majority-minority districts. McNellis, who owns a mortgage brokerage business, was first elected to the council in 2010 and re-elected twice. He didn't return phone calls for comment about his appointment for his fourth term. Although the city passed term limits law in 2020, those limits only apply to newly elected members, not those who were on the council before the law was passed. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ in Santee, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, in the heart of San Diego's East County.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. You can support independent public media for our region. Please support KNSJ by making a donation or a sustaining monthly pledge of any amount at www.knsj.org. We're your community radio station, KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, serving the San Diego border region from the mountains to the sea. That's www.knsj.org. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. And today, my very special guest is Dilquaz Ahmed. She is the executive director of License to Freedom, an El Cajon-based nonprofit with a mission to promote promote peaceful and safe relationships in immigrant and refugee communities locally through services that build resilience and self-sufficiency, support healing from trauma and violence, and advocacy for equity and justice. Dilquaz, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You know, Miriam, I love you and I love your magazine. Oh. In the busy, busy day, I could never say no to you.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on. Your agency has been providing counseling to the 9 children of a Syrian refugee family in El Cajon after their father, Abdulhanan Alrawi, was unfortunately arrested, allegedly for shooting and killing their mother while the children were in the home. Our hearts, I think all of us can say that our hearts go out to the children after such a terrible tragedy. You've been counseling them. Can you bring us up to date on how the children are doing, you know, their ages and what's going to happen to them now?
Oh, Miriam, they are going, I don't know how they are going to do. They asked me that question and I told them, I don't know. Let's figure it out because it's so hard. I don't have answer. I don't know. It's difficult.
Are they separated right now or are they together?
No. So this is like, you know, in the situation like that, the community gets together. And we were so fortunate that the Syrian, Iraqi community, even the Somalis community, because the babysitter was Somalis, and they all got together and they say, we're going to host the kids. So one of the friends, family friends, they were so close friends from Syria, mm-hmm. he decided to take the kids.
Oh my gosh, all 9 of them.
And he has 7 kids.
Wow.
And in
that's heartwarming. That's very heartwarming to hear.
It is. So so the husband and wife, they were best friend. Wife was best friend with the mom. She mm-hmm. shared a lot of beautiful memory. They were going together to ESL class. They were just going shopping. They spent most of the time like eating together, having conversation. Oh, and it's just heartbroken. They did not sleep.
And the kids range in age from
2 years old until 17. The youngest 2, the oldest 17 years old.
Oh my goodness.
Yesterday, for the first time, we got the key to go to the house and we opened the door for the first time, you know.
How was that?
Oh my goodness. I don't know. My heart, the boy, he just ran to mommy's bedroom. He grabbed her robe wrapped it around.
And that's where she died. She died in the bedroom.
He wrapped it around.
Did they see what happened or were they asleep when this occurred?
Were asleep. Nobody see what happened. Nobody know.
We should put in here that Mr. Alrawi has pleaded not guilty, and the court has prohibited him from seeing his children, although apparently he is allowed to have contact via phone and letters and so forth. Mr. Alrawi's friends, some of them, have voiced shock at what happened. Some of them have said he was a pillar in the community, known for helping other people. You know, they couldn't believe that he could do this. Did you know either of the parents or anyone in this family before this happened, Dilquaz? Or can you tell us anything about them before this?
No, they never. Nobody, even when I've been trying to talk to the kids every day to see mm-hmm. if there's any kind of violence, they say never. They say my mom and my dad, they were in love. They kept showing me video of mom.
Oh my God.
The day she got your U.S. citizen, dad went, he bought her a beautiful gold necklace. He was kissing her. Oh. So I told her, what happened that day? They say we were, because they have a small swimming pool. So they say we were all swimming. Mom was making food. Dad was taking video. Everything was good. Like nobody mentioned anything about any type of violence because we don't know. We don't know. They were not our client. They never contacted
us. Yeah. I mean, I know there were some neighbors who said they heard arguing and some said this had gone on, you know, for months, but some of the friends said they only lived there for a couple of weeks. So it cast some doubt on how accurate, you know, that is, if at all.
That was so difficult. And the kids were so sad. First, this family, they just moved a month ago. Second, they mm-hmm. say, we always have friends. Of course, we were swimming. We were yelling. Yeah. This is part of the culture. When we talk, we yell. They say, like, they have no right. The kids were so, like, they were so disappointed what the neighbors say, and they were so heartbroken by their statements. Yeah,
I can only imagine, just adding to the pain they're already going through. So how long had this couple or the family been in the United States in El Cajon? And what can you tell us about what you've learned since then about the trauma that they perhaps had been through in war-torn Syria and in their time as refugees?
As other, Syrian refugees, those people, they flee war. They were able to survive death and war in Syria to make it safe to United States, adapt a new culture, a new home, not just a new country home. They had big dreams. All of them. Mom want to go to school to, learn English. Dad want to work. He was working full-time. Kids.
What kind of work did he do?
He was working as a security guard for one of the company. So he was working during night and coming home at 5 a.m.
Yeah.
So they've been here for 6 years. They came 6 years ago. They were in Florida for 3 years. And after that, they moved to San Diego in 2019. Okay. So they've been in San Diego for 2 years and a half.
What are, without singling out this family specifically, what are some of the stresses and the pressures that are facing refugee families in our region, especially those with large families? San Diego, of course, is a very expensive place to live, highest housing market in the nation as of a couple of months ago. And what are the main stresses and pressures that you're seeing on them? And what could be done to help reduce some of those pressures that families are under?
In general, refugees right now facing one of the biggest issues, housing. Housing. As you know, most of the Afghan, newcomers, they're still on the motel because they have 7, 9 kids. And remember, they all have extended family. They brought their grandma, their grandpa, their dad, their mom, and they don't like to be separated. So it's so difficult to find, 4-bedroom apartment because it's very expensive. Talking about El Cajon, 2-bedroom is $2,600 right now.
Yeah.
El Cajon.
I've wondered sometimes if we need to change the zoning laws or something to allow building of things that would house larger extended families like that so people could stay
together. You know, we don't have anybody to lobby for the refugee. We have, but we are not there. We don't have a voice in the city council of El Cajon. And so that's why nobody lobby for the refugee community, for low income, for bringing low income apartment, from bringing affordable housing. We don't have that voice there. Maybe in the future, we have to advocate and work to have our voice to be heard. But right now in the city of El Cajon, in addition, we don't have rental control policy. So people can raise their rent as much as they want.
And the federal government provides only very short-term help for refugees. I was kind of surprised that how little it is, how quickly it runs out. Maybe you can clarify that. But also, is it true that it's basically the same no matter where you go? So if you're settled into an area where housing costs are low, you get the same amount as if they settle you in a place like San Diego, where the housing prices are very high. Should there maybe be some kind of sliding scale there so that to allow for the cost of living in the area that people are placed?
Or maybe provide, at least, that's what I say. Say when refugee arrive, if we can provide them with 1 year, only 1 year, until they settle, they will gain some, knowledge about how the system works.
Yeah, they only get, what is it, a month or 1 month, 2 months?
2, 3, 4 months. It's not very low. So once, if they can be settled for 1 year later on, they can apply for driver license, they can drive, they can get a car, and they can apply for jobs. So we don't have that system. But sometimes people say why they are coming to San Diego. Refugee people, they feel safer to be around their families and friends. Right. They can go to the place like New Mexico, for example. They can rent a house for $500, but they feel lonely. They don't have the mosque, they don't have their church, they don't have their their, you know, community.
Right. Access to transit, all those things. Yeah.
Unrelated, you know. Here they can practice their identity. They're proud who they are. But I think there is a price for everything. Price of housing here, yes.
Yeah, they always say we get part of our income in sunshine in San Diego, exactly. But yes. That doesn't pay the rent. How prevalent, of course, we don't know the circumstances of this yet, whether it was really a homicide or an accident or what happened in this tragic situation. But how prevalent is the problem of domestic violence among refugee communities? Are there cultural differences between some of the places they came from and, you know, the culture here that is a factor that you're addressing with your nonprofit efforts?
I remember, Miriam, domestic violence, it could happen anytime, right. Anywhere. It's across the limitation of where you are from, you know, educational background, age, religion. It could happen to any time.
Right. It certainly happens here.
So it's happened. Domestic violence in the refugee community, we see a lot of domestic violence, but the same thing that we see it in the mainstream, like, you know, community also, that it is. But I always say what's the difference is tool. That the refugee community, they don't have the tool that American people does. Mm-hmm. When they come here, they don't know how the justice system works. You know, they're afraid if they report the incident, because they say if you do that, you will lose your immigration status, or the CPS will take their kids away from you. So those are the things. The tool is different. Otherwise, domestic violence happens everywhere.
Right. But I mean, there's some places where it's not treated like a serious crime as here. So there's that issue also. People need education to learn the differences in the laws here.
You know, prevention program. We need prevention program. What happened is with COVID, we cannot get a lot of people in one place. We used to have a community dialogue for change. It's been running for years. We used to work with the newcomers, addressing, supporting them, how to navigate the system, what you do in case of domestic violence, child abuse, how to prevent it. Right now, you can't put 10 people together, you know, with the COVID regulations. We have to be worried with masks. So people, they don't even want to go to any gathering. We are worried. They are worried. So COVID changed a lot of things. COVID changed program. COVID changed how we function. COVID changed how we have to be worried about keeping the safety of people.
Right.
So, but if you say education is a key, and ongoing education, not one time, like you go clean your house one time, you say it's clean, it's done. It's maintenance. You have to maintain it. You have to, you know, look for new things, how to clean it faster, it's education and prevention is like that, maintenance. So you have to be able. And to be honest, our office is small. If we can get, we cannot get more than 8 people. You know, we used to have a big space that we lost.
Yeah.
And it just COVID changed a lot of things.
Yeah.
But domestic violence is something we need to, like, I know with the Afghan community, I say, let's just get there. Do this prevention and intervention before they get there. We already have 2 families there. They took a kids from, you know, one almost new family, and they were in a process to take the other one. So I go and I talk to the community. I say, let's just do something before, you know, that become
good for you.
Just, yes.
Tell us a little bit more about your License to Freedom nonprofit, why you founded it, and what services you provide.
I founded that organization. It's to prevent this type of incident.
Yeah.
To be willing to meet the needs of refugee community when it comes to issues of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. Mm-hmm. To create a space for people to come to talk, to reflect, to be able to have the safe space, even they don't want to address domestic violence, but they will feel there is a safe space for them. Once they're ready, they will come. This is how we came to, you know, create the license to freedom. It's just for people to come seek services, to get services, services that respectful with their culture, with their language, with their background, with their, you know, it just address all of the aspect that they will be looking for. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we are unique. We are the only organization to address the cultural and linguistic, to have the cultural and linguistic part.
Yeah,
I know actually, when the refugee community walk to our organization, I understand. She has issue, but she's not ready. So I know I came from that culture. I know that could be my mom or my sister or my cousin or anybody. Yeah.
And you yourself are from...
I'm from Iraq.
Iraq, right.
Yes, yeah, I'm Kurdish from Iraq. Yes.
Kurdish. If someone out there watching or listening to this today is experiencing domestic violence, where can they get help? Or is there a number they can call right now if someone wants or needs, is ready for help?
You know, anybody, I would just like to tell them that two things. You are not alone and it's not your fault. You are not alone, it's not your fault. If you find yourself in a domestic violence situation, you don't even have to mention your name. Call us 619-401-2800 or call our domestic violence advocate. We have Afghan domestic violence advocate, Iraqi domestic violence advocate. We speak Arabic, Farsi, Dari, and Russian. So 619-635-7332 or call 619-401-2800.
Very good. And what is the website for License to Freedom?
www.licensetofreedom.org. So we offer crisis intervention and we provide free legal services. We have three attorneys providing them with legal consultation. If you want to file restraining order, divorce, child support, child custody, or legal consultation, it's free. We don't have a waiting list. We have entrepreneur program, which we had 21 women graduated last year from our program. 21 women started their own small business last year. This year, the state extended this program, SEED program, for another 2 years. So we are going to help 20 Afghan women and 20 Arab women to start their small business here in San Diego.
That's so great.
We have youth program, big youth program. We support the youth. How to achieve their goal, to apply for college, to, if they have any struggling in their life, to come to our safe space to talk so we can support them achieving their goals. We have, of course, COVID-19. We've been working with COVID-19, trying to talk to people to get the vaccine, to get, you know, accurate information from our agency when it comes to COVID. And we also have one of biggest culturally and linguistically mental health program. We have 16 marriage family therapists at License to Freedom. They all bilinguals. They speak Arabic, Russian, Dari, Farsi, you mean it, Arabic, Kurdish, you mean it. So we provide in-home mental health services. We send the team, like, for example, for this family of the Syrian community who are in crisis, we send 2 to 3 therapists home to help them, to provide them with what they need, to do expressive art therapy, to play with kids, to take them to mall. I don't know. Like, we have a unique mental health services. And our therapists, they all train in issues of trauma-informed care, not just the therapists, our team all, you know, it's train very, very well how to deal with crisis, how to respond to need of survivor of domestic violence, how to offer empathy and sympathy. Not sympathy itself is not enough. Adding empathy, you know, to the sympathy, you know, and be able to talk to people, to walk in their shoes, to make sure that their need it's being met. Make sure that we understand where they are coming from, understand the level of trauma, understand those people survive war, they cannot trust anybody. Create this space to be able to trust us. So yes, start a good conversation. Yes, yes.
Miriam.
Back to the Al-Rawi family. Is there anything that the public can do to help these children? Do they have any needs? You know, is there a site for donations or clothing or anything else for them? And, for that matter, and also to help other refugee families in need.
Right now, when I asked them yesterday, of course, a lot of people came. I've been called every day. People providing clothing, new shoes, like everything, food, gift card. People are so nice. And this is San Diego.
Yeah, we have big hearts.
San Diego, those people made me to be who I am. Believe me, when 22 years ago I came to this country, those people supported me to be who I am. San Diego people, those good people who picked for that left, you know, and they are wonderful. Those are matter. This is when I look at the San Diego, those are the people who matter that I always talk about them. Yesterday, I asked the kids, what do you need? We need peace. We need the media to stop blaming my dad, talking about this guy from Syria. We want to go back to school, feel safe that nobody will bully us and point their finger. We need the media. We need people to leave us alone. And I think what those people need, they need peace.
Yeah.
Because they want to go back to their home. They need their neighbor, you know, as just to be more careful, to knock their door, to bring them soup and say, how can we be supportive?
Yes. You know,
they don't want anybody to ask them about the incident. They want peace. And you know what they told me? We even don't want anybody to talk about our dad because my dad is the hand of justice. And let's just the justice, you know, to find out if he killed a mom or not. Yeah. With the kids always say, we doubt even 0%. So this is their kids. They still love dad. They lost their mom and they don't want to lose their dad.
Yeah,
so
they're hoping the accusations aren't true. And what about for the other refugee families? They're not the only family here that's had struggles, certainly. If people want to help other newly arrived refugee families, what's the best way that someone out there can do that?
The best way is to knock their doors, to not be afraid to open conversation, to use the language of heart. Go, don't say, I don't speak Farsi or Dari. We human, we have different kind of connection. We can connect to each other. Knock their door, say, how can I help you? Those people, somebody called me from Fletcher Parkway. They say, there's a woman, she's about to die. She's so weak. We are afraid that she's dying.
Oh, my gosh.
When I send our crisis counselor, she talked to her. She's, of course, Afghan. This woman just got a baby. She was bleeding. And she has a infection on her teeth.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. She couldn't talk to anybody, you know. She's crying because her hand was under her chin and she was, you know, going around the, you know, backyard and everything. Thought she's crazy. She wasn't crazy. She was somebody who arrived, who just delivered a baby. She was, you know, bleeding. And in addition, she has pain on her teeth.
So reaching out and listening to our neighbors.
Listen to people and say, how can I be, you know?
Yeah. Are there organizations where people want to donate to help the refugees with whatever their needs might be? If some woman like that needed dental care or somebody needs whatever it might be, you know, financial.
Transportation. If people can provide transportation. For example, this is what I say. I say if people can donate their time once a week, 2 hours, to take one family to the beach, to library, show them how beautiful San Diego, you know, show them the school, talk to them.
What a wonderful thing to do.
After school program with the kids or teach mom how to speak or how to, you know, just survivor English. They don't have to be fluent. Something, I think everybody can do that.
Yes.
Offer their time, you know, just to support. Those people going to be ending up here in San Diego.
Right, I know some of them.
Our community, they will remember all their life when I came, because this is what I say. I say when I came, you know, Annette Badger family supported me a lot. My goodness, every time away when I think about them, I just want to cry.
Yeah,
they used to come take me to their home having dinner because I was by myself. Oh, this family, every time when I say, oh, resiliency, to me, resiliency was Annette Badger, who supported me all my life. And she made me to be who I am. And she says, you know what, Delquaz, you're on feet, you can do and go support others. So those people, they will remember that thing. They will remember somebody knocked their door, provide them with some soup,
yeah,
and help them.
Yes. I know, I remember a few years ago interviewing a lot of newly arrived refugees, and I specifically remember a woman who'd come from Africa, and she didn't know anything about San Diego. You know, they're placed here sometimes by an international placement agency or the UN, and she didn't know we had a beach. She didn't know she was living in San Diego within a couple miles of the ocean that she'd never seen before, and someone finally took her to see it. So you're right. Sometimes it's just the little things we can do.
A little thing can make a lot of change. You know, people who've been traumatized, people, especially like the Afghan community, you know, is mental health. That is therapy. When somebody will take them even once a month, because they have 7 kids, if 2 cars can, join 2 families, and you know what, they're very generous. They can make good food and Afghan rice and beef and salad. They're so generous. Like when we go visit them, they share whatever they have. You know, they open the fridge, they share, and they just run to the kitchen. They start to cook something. So generous, so generous.
Very good. Well, we are out of time for today. Is there any final thought, Delquaz, that you would like to leave with our audience today? And folks, if you just tuned in, we have been speaking with Delquaz Ahmed, the executive director of License to Freedom, which is an Alcohol-based nonprofit that helps refugee and immigrant families here in our region. Delquaz, I'll let you have the final word today on what you would like to leave with our viewers and listeners on the radio and viewers on East County Magazine.
Thank you. I don't know. I'm thankful. I'm thankful for everything. And I would like to just say, I'm thankful for the team who came together to support Alrawi's family's kids. I am so thankful for the Syrian community, for the host family who decided to take 9 kids. I'm thankful for the CPS. I'm thankful for the school district who step in and to, you know, see how they can help. I'm thankful for the community. I'm thankful for you, Miriam, who called me the day after to say what we can do for the kids. I'm thankful for everybody who tried to keep the peace for that family. I hope the media will slow down a little bit with the story and let the kids have some peace, especially they are grieving. It's time for them to focus on themselves, to grieve. They lost a beautiful young mom.
The police have not released the name of the mother, you know, who passed, the victim. But certainly if there are things that the family wants people to know about their mother and her life, or when, you know, when that name is released, we would certainly like to do that. I mean, to include the good memories they must have of their mother, so there's something positive in the media.
Maybe later on, the kids can talk to you. Maybe.
Yeah, when they're ready.
When they are ready, they can talk about the beautiful memory. Because grief, it doesn't mean you cry. Grief, talking about the memory that will stay with them alive, all their life. So I think if we can leave them alone a little bit, have them have some peace, have the media slow down with blaming and pointing finger on everybody. I think that's what the kids need right now. And that's what
I agree with you.
Yes. Thank you, Miriam.
Please. I want to thank you, Delquaz, for taking the time to come on for helping this family and so many families in need out there, and for taking the time to come on our show today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you very, very much. Thanks a lot, Miriam, and thanks for having me.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the Network for Social Justice.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show. If you would like to be the media, here's your opportunity. We're looking for some more talented volunteers for our East County Magazine radio show. So if you've got radio experience or just a great voice, Or if you'd like to get experience writing scripts or special reports for the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 619-698-7617 or send an email to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We're your community media, bringing you news from our region that reflects the public interest, not special interests.
As kids head back to school in California, experts say it's important to bring them in for a physical and get their hearing, vision, and teeth checked as well. A study from the Urban Institute found almost 1 in 5 parents delayed or skipped their kids' preventive visits during the pandemic, so now is the time to catch up. Dr. Aaron Shaw, a pediatric dentist in the Bay Area, says dental problems are linked to absenteeism.
Kids with dental problems are 3 times more likely to miss school than their peers without dental problems. And last time they tallied the amount of missed school hours, they tallied more than 51 million school hours lost to dental-related illness for school-aged children each year.
The American Optometric Association recommends children get their first comprehensive eye exam before their first birthday, again right before kindergarten, and if no issues are detected, every 2 years after that. Experts also say kids should keep their device screens at least 30 inches away and advise taking a break from the screen every 20 minutes to train their eyes on something at least 20 feet away. Dr. Donna O'Shea, National Chief Medical Officer with UnitedHealthcare, points out that regular hearing tests are also a must.
Like vision and dental, early detection of hearing issues is crucial for getting treatment as soon as possible. And that's really important because hearing loss can affect a child's ability to develop speech, language, and social skills.
O'Shea recommends young people follow the 60-60 rule, which means only using earbuds or headphones for less than 60 minutes at no more than 60% of the player's maximum volume. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
If you're looking for work, the city of Lemon Grove has jobs. They sent a tweet out August 25th that says, looking for a few talented professionals to join our team. The jobs currently available include fire inspector, maintenance service worker, public works operations, and administration manager, as well as senior management analyst. For details and job descriptions, as well as deadlines, you can go to lemongrove.ca.gov. Click on City Hall and Human Resources. Reporting for East County Magazine from Lemon Grove, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. You can support independent public media for our region. Please support KNSJ by making a donation or a sustaining monthly pledge of any amount at www.knsj.org. We're your community radio station, KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, serving the San Diego border region from the mountains to the sea. That's www.knsj.org.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
A fun place to visit in El Cajon is the Water Conservation Garden. Located on the Cuyamaca College campus, this garden is fully surrounded with flowers, plants, ponds, wildlife, and educational interactives. It's a place for both children and adults to enjoy and learn about water-wise gardening, fire-resistant landscaping, native plants, and vegetable gardens.
The garden is a flurry of activities. We have workshops here of every kind, about your landscape, about making cheese, crafting classes.
Not only is this park a great place to visit, but it has an important mission behind its purpose. Director of Operations and Programs, Pam Meisner, emphasized the focus of the garden is to educate on eco-friendly and efficient gardening. Miss Smarty Plants is one of the workshop programs she runs for kids.
I think the best part about being Miss Smarty Plants is that I get to see the innocence, the wonder of a child every day. I truly believe in my heart of hearts, our youth is going to save the earth.
The garden offers field trips for kids, yoga classes, and other events depending on the season, but is also a pleasant and relaxing place to walk amid a beautiful environment.
Once you know it's here and once you come here, you don't have to sell the garden. It sells itself.
Because this is a nonprofit organization, the garden's finances took a hit, causing it to require a submission fee for entry as opposed to being free.
We used to be a totally free garden. We used to be totally free. We changed to an admissions model in June when we were able to open back up.
The Water Conservation Garden is open Tuesday to Sunday, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. and open until 6 p.m. on Thursdays. For more information about the exciting and enjoyable things the Water Conservation Garden has to offer, visit the website at thegarden.org.
Miss Smarty Plant's mantra is, we can change the world with our own two hands.
And for East County Magazine, I'm Angela Kurish.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, AK Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show. This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show. If you would like to be the media, here's your opportunity. We're looking for some more talented volunteers for our East County Magazine radio show. So if you've got radio experience or just a great voice, or if you'd like to get experience writing scripts or special reports for the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 619-698-7617 or send an email to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We're your community media, bringing you news from our region that reflects the public interest, not special interests.